Potmatic Podcast. Woo-hoo! For May 2014.
Is it warm yet?
No, it's actually really cold the day that we're recording this.
That's sad.
So the Potmatic Podcast is a place where you can rock out with your library card out. We're like Entertainment Tonight, but for people who are too smart for their own good.
I call Mary Hart.
Call John Tesh.
Ah, damn it. Okay, I don't know who else was on that show.
Nope.
Mary's? Mary Hart.
That was a classic era. I don't know who
was. Yeah, I haven't watched it since John Tesh was on there.
But the people talking are...
Crystal.
Amanda.
Mike.
And I'm Brian. This show might be for people that are too smart for your own good, but I'm too dumb to know the difference. So, one of the great things that happens in Nashville in May is the Tennessee Renaissance Festival.
Huzzah!
Tennessee Renaissance Festival, you can travel back in time to 16th century England, or maybe Wales.
Not literally.
Not literally. But you can see all kind of Renaissance happenings, joustings, knife throwings, human chess, falconry, all done in period costumes, period food, period music. There are artisans and craftspeople from all over the country. They come and set up booths. Maybe the highlight is Castle Gwyn, a replica of a 12th century Welsh border castle. If you've ever driven from Murfreesboro to Franklin, you've probably seen Castle Gwyn and wondered, what the heck is that? Well, that's what it is. Now you know. So the festival draws people from all over. So today we're going to talk about our favorite Renaissance-themed stuff you can get and do at the library. We're going to interpret Renaissance as broadly as possible, probably about as broadly as all the craft booths at the Renaissance Festival. There might be some dragons. I don't know. And, yeah, that's the show. All right. What I was going to say is I love the Renaissance Festival. It's cool. It's educational. It's a good time. Unlike things at the library, you do have to pay to get in.
Oh.
So just so you know, we'll have a link to the website so you can figure out how much money you want to spend on turkey legs before you go. Okay.
How much gold doubloons you want to bring.
Any of my fellow podcasters, have you ever been to the Tennessee Renaissance Festival?
I hate Welsh people, so I'm not going to that Welsh castle.
Verily, I hath attended yon Renaissance Festival, yea, verily.
All right, that means yes.
For those in Tennessee, that means yes, y'all. I've never been, but I have a feeling my husband will be taking me this year. He's been, when's it coming? So.
Huzzah.
Right.
Exactly.
Well, how about a Renaissance festival anywhere in the country? I know there's a pretty big one in Pennsylvania, right?
You know, and there's like the whole Welsh thing and that. Can't go there.
Well, today I'm going to recommend some books that will get you prepared for the Renaissance festival experience.
Okay, got to do my homework.
And lady. Yes, homework. Do your homework. So first off, I must warn you that a Renaissance festival is not a strict historical reenactment. What RenFest does best is spark your curiosity to research what medieval times or Renaissance period, what they were really like. Take jousting, for example, that Brian mentioned in the introduction. For those not in the know, jousting is a competition between two people. They're on horseback. They've got big sticks, what you may call lances, and they're trying to strike each other while riding towards the opponent at high speed. And hopefully, when you strike your opponent, you're knocking him off his horse. Well, at the Tennessee Renaissance Festival, you can see a jousting tournament as part of the daily entertainment. If you want to learn more about the history of jousting, check out a book called Tournaments and Jousts, Training for War in Medieval Times. Now, another high point of a Renaissance festival, besides the turkey legs and the ale, is the human chess match. It's great rated PG fun, but if you know nothing about chess, you might find yourself a bit perplexed. Not to worry. NPL has lots of books and DVDs to help introduce you to the game, including a book called The Art of Chess. It's by art historian Colleen Schreifroth, and she's written a cultural and creative history of the game of chess. It starts in ancient times through the 20th century and beyond. So while you're walking around the Renaissance Festival, you might experience a scoundrel hurling insults at you. And imagine his surprise when you return the sentiment with a few zingers of your own. Read Shakespeare's Insults, Educating Your Wit. Now this summer, the Nashville Shakespeare Festival, woohoo, they'll be presenting As You Like It. And with that in mind, I thought I would put my fellow podcasters on the spot hurl some insults at one another.
I'd blow my nose at you.
So they have not read these insults yet, but now you can turn over. And Mike,
This is live action, folks.
That's right. Mike, you take it away.
Had to get my acting voice.
Acting genius. Yes. Thank you.
You're like the toad, ugly and venomous.
His brain is as dry as the remainder biscuit after a voyage.
You didn't even hear what I'm going to talk about yet.
Poor Brian. Brian, let's meet as little as we can.
By my troth, I was seeking for a fool when I found you.
You motley-minded gentleman.
These are all about me. The dullness of the fool is the whetstone of the wits.
How proved you that in the great heap of your knowledge?
I do frown on thee, sir, with all my heart, and if mine eyes can wound, now let them kill thee.
Ooh.
Ooh, can't follow that up, can we?
Yeah, I went there.
That's so, because this is an audio podcast, and you can't see the look on our face. But
I was
quivering
smiling
with rage.
So, read those books, and you'll be totally prepared for the Renaissance Festival experience. And Amanda, what are you going to tell us about today?
Well, since I am a Renaissance newbie, I tried to find a more random occurrence of the Renaissance Fair. And I think that I have mentioned before on the podcast the TV show Gilmore Girls. And I know that you're now pondering, okay, so what do two upper middle class women from Connecticut have to do with the Renaissance Fair? Well, if you've watched the show, it turns out that Lorelai is on again, off again. Boyfriend Luke, his sister Liz, comes back in about, she's kind of the flaky, you know, in and out mom, and she comes back in, I think it's about season 5, and has discovered that she has a talent for making jewelry, which she sells at Renaissance fairs. And actually a large portion of one of the seasons is she gets hurt and can't work her booth, and so her brother Luke has to go and help. So, like, you see there's footage shot at the Renaissance Fair, and you see all of the costumes and everything, except for Luke, who has his baseball cap on, and he refuses to wear the costume. And but I know, he's so rowdy. So that's one of my favorite Renaissance Fair moments. And I also have to give a shout-out to The Big Bang Theory for one of the episodes when they all, of course, they're all, you know, nerds, so they go to Renaissance Fairs. They all have their own costumes and whatever.
Of course.
In the one episode, Sheldon refuses to go back, but then they convince him he can go back dressed as Spock, traveling back in time to the Renaissance. So that's also highly enjoyable. So, Mike, what do you think about Renaissance fairs?
Well, see, when we got the email, it was like, think about the Renaissance in general. So, you know, I just thought about Renaissance in general, and it was a bit tricky. You know, I was hoping that the podcast topic could be a reason to actually read some books I got in the Renaissance that I got a couple of years ago. Like, you know, I got a book of Elizabethan revenge plays and, you know, a new translation of the Canterbury Tales from English into English.
That's a tricky translation.
Well, ye olde English. Oh. But instead, I'm going to talk about two books I've read a while ago, one of which, 15 years ago. So, you know. They even have a theme. Oh, boy. Okay. So we're going to go back in time to 1588 to the Spanish Armada. Ooh. First book is called The Armada by Garrett Manningly. It won the Pulitzer Prize in 1959. And even though it's like over...
Take that, Donna Tartt.
That's right. Goldfinch this. And even though it's like over 50 years old, I think. Yes. You know, it read like a novel. It's, like, really good. It was one of, like, the first nonfiction books I read that I really, really liked. Unlike a lot of those where it says, it read like a novel. Instead, it's like, you know, but there's, like, no characters and stuff. It's, like, you know, there's characters and you can kind of see what they think, but the guy based it on, you know, actual letters and all that sort of thing. And
silly research.
Yeah. Pish-pash, can't you just make up things? It's pretty cool because, I mean, it begins at the, you know, the execution of Mary, Queen of Scots. And I had no idea that that was, like, the big thing that started the Armada. And that event, like, reverberated across Europe. One of the really cool, like, side characters to me was, like, what was happening in France at the time? Because, you know, it's like Spain versus England, you know, that's the big deal. But in France, there was this whole civil war going on. And eventually, you know, spoiler alert, Henry of Navarre becomes Henri IV of France. And I thought it was pretty, like, he was an interesting dude because he was, like, really, like, an opportunist. When his uncle got, like, killed, the nobleman guys were like, well, we'll let you be king of France as long as you, like, you know, do be Catholic now. And he's like, well... Okay. I'll go over, you know, I'll skip the reason why I had the Civil War for decades and, you know.
I'd convert if someone offered me a throne.
Sure. Right now. Okay, guys. Sure. Until he was assassinated, I think it was like 10 years later or something.
So it didn't work out well for him in the long run.
I take it back. Stand right where I am.
In fact, people got so mad. I think I read recently that he had over 20 assassination attempts. So, you know, he had to dodge bullets a bunch of times. Pretty cool. But, you know, I thought it was really super cool, and, you know, if you're interested in this sort of thing, we do have one copy floating around in my book bag right now. Ha-ha. You get something that was touched by me. Cool. Lucky you. And the other book I got on the Armada is called The Silver Skull by, I believe it's Mark Chadburn. I forgot to write down his name.
Maybe you should figure that out before we do this.
Mark something.
It's by that one guy.
It's
you
by
know,
that dude who wrote that thing.
The thing about
well,
the people.
I refrain from asking Amanda which season of the Gilmore Girls. That sounds fair. But.
It's either five or six.
I'll work it out.
So.
I feel better. This one was pretty cool because it's basically kind of like, at some point, John Dee and others in England repel basically like the supernatural from the borders of England, and the fairies and assorted supernatural beasties get very mad and have a like cold war between like most of Europe and England, and they use the Spaniards as like their human proxies and stuff. And it's pretty cool. Like, I mean, even though it involves like fairies, they're not like your cuddly, like, you know, bright, you know, dragon wing flying around fairies. They're like, you know, creepy elves who like are vulnerable to cold iron, and very cruel and stuff.
So this one's nonfiction then?
This is the nonfiction. That's right.
Okay. <just checking.
laughs> It's pretty cool. You know, my grandpa was a fairy. And it's like, like the hero Will Swift has to like get these magical items and get them away from Spain before the fairies get a hold of them. And it's pretty cool, pretty cool. And I think the climax of the book is in the Spanish Armada, because if I remember right, because it's kind of fuzzy, like he's actually on one of the boats. I think he's on the flagship of the Armada as it's heading towards England and stuff. And he's captured and stuff. And ooh, can he escape? Will England be saved? Will the Armada take over England? You know, maybe I should have read this one first. I don't know. tune in by reading The Silver Skull by Mark something or other. How about you, Brian?
When you were talking about, you know, things that happen in history and, like, there's spoilers, this is the thing that's been nagging me, but all this press coverage about Game of Thrones. So
Crystal has left the building.
And maybe Game of Thrones counts right on the Renaissance show, right? But the librarian in me, the curmudgeon librarian in me, which I've learned I have a persona that people view me that way.
I don't know where they would have gotten that from.
it's just annoyed that, like, these books have been published for years. They're super popular. The spoilers are known. How can there be spoilers? I don't get it. Illiteracy annoys me. Okay, I'm done. So what you were asking me about, what was tickling my fancy, or stuff about the Renaissance. Oh, I remember now. The stuff about hating Welsh people, I lied. I love Wales. And I know more about medieval Wales than I do about the American Civil War. Is that weird?
You're president of the John Rhys-Davies fan club?
I'm president of the John Cooper Poise fan club.
Check it, mate.
I enjoyed... One of the reasons that, you know, I enjoyed Torchwood was because it was actually set in Wales. So the Torchwood headquarters is actually in Cardiff. It's great. But anyway, and that was like one of the themes of the show too, like the Welshness of the characters. I enjoyed it a lot. But let's just time out. Let's go way back in time. So, okay, Renaissance, Middle Ages, Dark Ages, maybe the very beginning of the Middle Ages. Let's go back to the 7th century in Britain.
Ooh, that's a good one.
And of course, I'm talking about Hild, the new novel by Nicola Griffith. And so Hild is a new historical, it's a fictional biography of Hilda of Whitby, who was a 7th century nun and a saint now. And she founded the Abbey of Whitney. And in the Dark Ages in Britain, like, kings would come and use her as an oracle. She's known for her wisdom, and the legends are that she helped convert what is now England to Christianity. Now, this is where this takes place is actually not in Wales. It's actually in what we would now call England. But basically, the whole island at that time were all these warrior princes and warlords that just killed each other all the time. So if you're thinking, like, you know what, I don't really want to read, you know, this thing about this, you know, this nun who founded an abbey, like, why is that interesting? Well, it's because, you know, it's at a time when life is nasty and brutal and short, and just everyone is just killing each other and poisoning each other, and it's ultra violent. And I think, you know, she makes up a lot, because the history from this time period is basically just a big long list of male names who killed each other. So she gets to make up, how does this woman actually, you know, get to be so much power and become this great historical figure in the history of England? And it's a long book, and I'm only 100 pages in. But really gets me on books is the prose, and man, this chick can write, and she works in all these old English words. And I'm just totally nerding out. At the beginning, there is a genealogy chart, because there's so many characters, and like, they're all real historical people. Like, she's done her research. At the end, there's a glossary of the old English words. And I'm reading it, you know, digitally, and I'm like, you know, this, I got to read this on paper. You know, this is a book you got to be touching wood whenever you read it. And I realized, though, actually it would really suck to not have Wikipedia, because there's like so many words that, like, I don't even know. And Nicola Griffith, you know, in the past, she's known for being, if you're going to pigeonhole her, a feminist science fiction author. And she's won, like, all the science fiction awards you can win. She's won them. All the sort of, like, gay, queer awards, she's won them all. And it's interesting, she's sort of, you know, got out of the genre ghetto by writing really well. She hasn't put out a book in 6 years, and this book was published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux, the fancy publisher?
Zero.
So it's like a 600-page hardback by a major publisher, and it's like, well, awesome. And what's she been doing for 6 years? She's been researching this book. And so the other thing that it's about, you know, ties in with, you know, the rest of her books is, you know, it's about, like, what women were doing, because all the history that we have during this time is just men killing each other. So, like, what was the actual, what were women's lives like during the Middle Ages? So, yeah, I'm into it. And so far, it's really good. So things that maybe kind of relate to, if maybe, you know, Hild isn't speaking to you. Wolf Hall by Hilary Mantel, another author, like a really cool feminist author who sort of like reinterprets history. In Wolf Hall, it was her novelizations of the life of Thomas Cromwell. Not as far back in time, maybe a little bit more relatable. But if you're really nerdy, you could go back a few more decades to Kristin Lovren's daughter, but Sigrid Undset. And so Sigrid Undset wins the Nobel Prize for Literature for her series of novels about Kristin Lovren's daughter. And it's basically a chronicle of medieval Finland, I believe. Now I'm scared. It's set in Norway. You know, it's one of the things it's all about is that's, you know, it's historical research about what life was like in Norway in the Middle Ages. And, okay, on-air quiz or on-air poll. Oh. Should I mention items that have to be interlibrary loaned?
Yes.
Sure. Yeah, that could be fun.
Why not?
All right. Okay, so.
It's unanimous.
So I name dropped this Welsh author earlier, John Cooper Poyse. So he wrote this novel called Porius, this big, long, really detailed novel about like 1 week in medieval Wales in 499. And it is just like the book I'm going to read when I retire. And if you're into it, you know, if you like Hild, maybe you should check out Porius by John Cooper Poyse. Now, okay.
We have Hild? MBL has Hild?
Hild is a brand new book.
Oh.
Right? It just came out. It's getting awesome reviews. And even though it seems like difficult in a good way, I'm very proud that I had to buy it to read it because the holds list is so long. Mm-hmm. So Nashville, maybe you're just gearing up for the Renaissance Festival, but you make me proud. You're reading the hard, tough books that put wrinkles on your brain. Now, maybe that's not your deal. Maybe you're like, I got enough wrinkles.
I want to see the Doctor Who episode where he goes back in time and meets Hild. That's more my speed.
So it's some non-cloister action.
Well, to make this, okay, just to make this even better, Hild is like, it's over 500 pages, and I think it's only from her childhood to adulthood, and it's like the first volume.
So it's going to be a trilogy?
I don't know. Well, you know what? If it doesn't sell, it's going to be a single volume. But anyway, okay. Maybe you got enough wrinkles on your brain or anywhere else. Okay, you wanted to go to like medieval Wales, medieval England, medieval Britain where they're fighting. Ellis Peters, the Cadfael series, right? Oh, yeah. Same kind of deal. Ellis Peters herself is a linguist. Awesome mysteries, historically accurate. And it's really good too because Hild is all about the borders because Hild is sort of like mixed cultural descent. She's actually like English and British, like sort of like mixed together, if you know the difference, if you care to know the difference. And so is Cadfael. You know, Cadfael lives in Shrewsbury, which is on the border between Wales proper and, you know, what would become England. And that's one of the things that Cadfael is about, you know, the cultural differences. So check out Cadfael, some really great murder mysteries.
And there also there was a TV series of Cadfael, mm-hmm, with Derek Jacobi.
Yes.
Do we have those on DVD? A couple.
We do.
Maybe.
We used to replace them if we no longer do.
We have a couple because I'm a Welshophile and I got them replaced. So.
So you're the Prince of Wales?
Maybe. Oh, that's a whole other conversation. Do you know how you get to be the Prince of Wales?
Be the second in line to the throne of England?
Yes. There's a ceremony called the investiture where you're given the Wales, the country of Wales, basically as a sweet 16 present.
Really?
Yes.
Ooh. So, I could totally ignore the podcast and hear more about this.
But okay, you're interested, right? You want to know about that?
I am.
The library just got a new DVD set called The Story of Wales. If you care about the Middle Ages and Renaissance, you want Disc 1, Part 2, Power Struggles, and Disc 2, Part 2, England and Wales. Well, all about the Middle Ages and the Renaissance and all these princes and kings killing each other and early Christianity on the British Isles. If you watch the whole way to the end, you get to the whole...
end, I have to sit through like 10 hours of...
Well, okay. No, it's maybe 6 hours. It's okay. Three discs, two episodes on each disc, right? And it was produced by BBC Wales and Open University, and it's actually like Welsh history from a Welsh perspective. It's not, you know, history of the British Isles from a sort of world perspective or from an English perspective. So this new DVD set that we have is actually like Welsh history from the Welsh perspective. So that's very interesting. And speaking of that, most people don't know this, but the Scottish Heritage Festival was just here. And in August 2014, you know, there's a national referendum to decide if Scotland's going to devolve from the United Kingdom. Like, that's really fascinating. So I know if that actually happens, you know, the National Party of Wales will just be dancing in the streets. But it's like, there's hope. That's all I got. Though, the other movie I thought of was... Lancelot du Lac by Robert Bresson, or Lancelot of the Lake, which is an awesome movie about King Arthur's court and jousting, but totally unlike any version that you've ever seen before, like a morality play.
Not Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
There's that, too. That's the opposite, right? If you get
that's more my speed. Ding.
I can't let the podcast end without mentioning the George Saunders story in his collection, 10th of December, My Chivalric Fiasco, because it's about people that work at this Renaissance theme park, and they're, like, controlled by drugs. Like, this will make you act like a knight. If you take this, like, the nobility, whatever, drug, you act noble, whether you are or not. But what happens is they give it to a guy who knows that supervisor has actually been like sexually harassing one of the other employees. So once he takes the night drug, he has to be honest about it. He just gets his kicked by the security guards and thrown out of the Renaissance Fair. And that's My Chivalric Fiasco by George Saunders. Hilarious story.
So I wanted to sum up after we shared all of our recommendations that if you've ever, you know, felt like you didn't fit in, felt alone, misunderstood, if you go to a Renaissance Festival, I guarantee you're going to feel at home. You know, I always marvel at all the people of all ages and cultural backgrounds and lifestyles and belief systems. You know, you've got
costume
levels. You know, there's the jocks, the geeks, the hippies, the cool kids. They're all there together, and they're just having a good time. So you should, too.
Have a turkey leg.
Get a kiss from a wench.
To me, Renaissance means Donatello's David and not turkey legs.
Well, the whole Renaissance Festival is more like the medieval festival. It was a Renaissance Festival. It would be people with, like, you know, weird cloth and talking about science and, you know, painting frescoes. And
Good point.
What's tickling my fancy this month? So just to continue this Renaissance theme a tad, what's tickling my fancy is the TV show The Guild. And, you know, in the medieval times, you know, guilds existed and they were like, you know, the Leather Makers Guild or whatever. But this is about a guild inside a massively multiplayer online role-playing game. It remains unnamed, but it's sort of based on the World of Warcraft. And it's about all the players that are in this one guild. And, you know, it's mostly, like, the players in real life. Like, a lot of it's sort of, like, shot, like, through their webcams, you know, like, as they play the game. And then slowly they all get to know each other and they get into hijinks. And they're all these really deeply flawed, lovable losers. And they're all sort of, at first they're all frenemies, but then by the end of the show they're actually good friends. And I think it's really great for anyone that has ever played a role-playing game, either on paper or online. I can never get into online games, but I played paper role-playing games, and I still got all the jokes. It was just really hilarious. And the show was not afraid to confront gamer stereotypes. It was like, you know, all the weird stereotypes about role-playing gamers that are there. They make really funny jokes about them. The best, though, the one joke that I just totally love is the one girl's computer catches on fire, and she doesn't want to, but she has to ask, like, the snot-nosed like smart mouth kid to come and fix her computer for her, like in her guild. And when he comes, she's like, he has a new video card for her computer, and she's like, that says public library on it, where did you get that? And he's like, he says, I'm a member of the public, I borrowed it. That's like dear to my heart. So the show was written and produced by Felicia Day, and outside of the guild, she's probably best known for small parts in Josh Whedon products, Buffy and Dollhouse and Dr. Horrible Sing Along. So she's really the engine of the show. And, you know, it was an online series. And her character, Codex, her in-game character's name is Codex, and her real-life name is Sid. You know, she's really the main character of the show. And it started as an online series. I've watched an episode of it online, you know, over the years, and it's never really got its hooks in me. But now it's available on Netflix and DVD, and the library just ordered the DVDs. But I watched it on Netflix, and as I was watching The Guild on Netflix, I just felt like a complete loser. Because I was like, here is a web TV show about nerds, and I didn't even watch it when it came out. I'm watching it at home on Netflix, which is like, I don't know, I just felt like I'm like so out of the loop. I'm watching nerd stuff after the fact. But then when I actually watched it, though, I understood what the show was about and what its appeal was and how well it was written. Like, it was really funny. You really learned to love the characters. It really makes jokes about gaming, you know. It's like, wow, this is a really good show. And it won, like, the small number of awards that you can win for a web show. Like, it won them all, and I see why. And I realized how funny and smart it was. And I wouldn't have ever, I think, watched it if I hadn't, like, sat down and watched it on Netflix. Because I just think still watching a show on a computer in a little window, like on YouTube, it's just not the same experience as, like, sitting down at home in a chair, you know, with your cat and, you know, chilling out and actually getting into a show.
Well, I think I watched a couple episodes back when it was just coming out, and they were really short. Like, I mean, like, 12 minutes maybe. And so that was what kind of got me, is that with sitting down and watching it on Netflix, you can do a bigger span of time and get more into the story, as opposed to basically, like, a little segment and a little segment and a little segment. But I just remember when it came out, like, I remember everybody was talking about The Guild and The Guild, and you watch The Guild, and The Guild is, you know, and it was everywhere. Because it was out about the same time Dr. Horrible was, and that was kind of
to use that vehicle to kind of drive traffic to the guild. And
so on Netflix or the DVDs, how it works is like season one will be like all 10 or 12 short episodes, but you can just sit down and watch them
like in one hour and a half about. Yeah, because they're about.
By the end season, there were six seasons. By the sixth season, like a whole quote unquote season is an hour and a half.
Mm-hmm.
So you could just sit down and watch
it. It's like a big movie.
Yeah, and even in that hour and a half, there'll be like one plot arc that resolves itself.
Mm-hmm. So I was going to ask, so she's not making any more? Like the guild has finished its.
As far as I know, like it has finished. And she runs. I don't think it existed before. I think the guild funded Geek and Sundry, which is her sort of online video network, which has the show Tabletop, which I've talked about before.
Tabletop's great.
And it just, did you fund their Indiegogo for season three?
I was thinking about it, but I never got around to it. But still, good show.
That's what I got.
All right. I've been baking pies. Recipes from a new super awesome cookbook called 4 and 20 Black Purds, the pie book. It's by the Elson sisters, who own a pie shop in Brooklyn. And even cooler than that, they just opened a cafe at the Brooklyn Public Library on Pie Day in March.
Pie Day.
So these are really interesting recipes, like strawberry basil pie, lavender honey custard pie.
They don't really put blackbirds in a pie, do they?
No, I don't. You'll have to read the cookbook to find out. I just made over the weekend the green chili chocolate pie that had jalapeno and ginger and lime with chocolate, and it was so good. And so I encourage you, if you're wanting to bake some pies, maybe strawberry rhubarb. We've got Kentucky Derby coming up. They have a Derby-ish pie recipe in their cookbook. Check it out, 4 and 20 Blackbirds, a pie book. All right, Amanda, what's tickling your fancy?
Okay, well, I've had a book checked out for a while and almost turned it back in because I have so many books checked out that I can't read them all. And so I was going through the cover of it, and I was like, it was about a guy who's really good at pattern recognition. Like, he picks up numbers, and then I had a feeling it was going to be like kind of like a James Patterson, like a thriller. And so I'm like, okay, well, this sounds good. So I was sat down, and I was going to read it. This is a very exciting book. It's called The Ascendant. It's by Drew Chapman. And right now, it's the only, like, the ending is open, so obviously something else could happen. But right now, it's the only one, like, he doesn't have 14 books planned out from just this one start. And this is his first novel. He has written a bunch for, it didn't name drop and say which movies, but it gave him movie credits from Hollywood. And you can tell. So the basic premise is that our main character, Garrett, is this whiz kid who dropped out of Harvard when his brother was killed in Iraq, I believe, or Afghanistan. I can't remember which one. He was in the military. And he goes to work for an old professor in the bond market in New York, and he finds this code in, like, a treasury sell-off happens, and I don't exactly understand. Like, I guess they all have numbers on them, and he recognized all the numbers and put together. So figured out that there's this whole conspiracy happening that China's trying to take over the United, like, to crash, like, they end up crashing Google. There's a real estate sell-off in Las Vegas. And so the government recruits Garrett to come in and, like, basically stop them and, like, reverse this so that we don't have World War III, even though it's kind of a new war. So we're not actually firing guns at each other, but they're still doing some pretty big damage. So it was a very, like, I didn't want to stop reading it. I wanted to keep it. It's fairly long. It's like 350 pages, I want to say. And it kind of reminded me a little bit of 24, but a more intellectual 24. Like, it wasn't quite as, oh, look, something blew up and there's terrorists. Oh, look, something blew up and there's terrorists. Like, there actually was a decent plot underneath it. So if you're looking for a new thriller, I would definitely recommend The Ascendant. And right now it's a one-off, so you don't have to do big commitment, just little commitment.
Well, I was thinking of talking about two movies that were based on books this month that I recently saw these movies, and I was like, wow, I need to check out these books. So this is kind of I've heard that they're based on books. You could check them out. We can find out they're good together, because I don't know if they're actually good, but the movies are good. I could totally vouch for those.
So the source material, the movie, yeah. It's great. So the source material must be, too.
It's got to be awesome. So first thing that I'm going to discuss is the Grand Budapest Hotel. Now, you know, Wes Anderson's one of those divisive things. You either love him or you hate him with the intensity of a thousand suns.
Guilty.
And, you know, it's kind of like when you ask a dog person about cats.
For the first time ever, Amanda and I agree on something on the podcast.
Wow. See, you guys. No fun. See.
It's a Pi Day miracle.
I watched the entire movie. I had a smile on my face the entire time. Had a great time. It was cool. I'm thinking of seeing it in the theater again. It could be his best movie. Even better than the Royal Tenenbaums, which I also adored, and I watched 5 or 6 times the first time, you know, when it came out on DVD. And I was surprised that the very first thing after the end of the movie is based on the works of Stefan Zweig, a Austrian writer who was very popular in the early 20th century. And apparently, like, he took some of the plot elements from 3 different books, one of which the library actually has, and it's called The World of Yesterday, which is kind of like Barbara Tuchman's The Proud Tower, that kind of, like, you know, how awesome Europe used to be before World War One, and, like, you know, that kind of the glory days of, like, you know, when everything was great and, you know, things were shiny and, you know, before the war killed generations of stuff. And mainly it focuses on, like, you know, Vienna, but he also moved around Europe, and he talks about how, you know, it was a different era. And there's supposedly some anecdote near the middle where he stays at a pretty awesome hotel in Budapest. So presumably the Grand Budapest Hotel was named after this one part. Also, the library has the Wes Anderson collection, which is a big, huge picture book of different Wes Anderson movies that have, like, big close-ups on, like, the handmade lists that are in every single one of his movies, and interviews with Wes Anderson during the making of each of the movies. And it's really cool. And I had, like, once we got it downstairs, like, Susan's like, you know, would you like this? And I'm like, I don't want to check it out. I want to own that. I want to, like,
love
ooh.
It and squeeze it.
Yeah, that's right. It's been near my bed for the past month. Oh, yes. And the other movie I saw recently is called Under the Skin, a science fiction film. It is really, really weird, which is probably why I like it. You know, I like those weird, like, really weird, thinky kind of science fiction movies. And basically, Scarlett Johansson plays this alien who seduces men into her creepy van and takes them into her house and does things to them. It's pretty awesome. Like, it's the downside is that there's a lot of, like, staring in the distance. A lot of, like, you know, hey, you know, and not talking. And so, like, normally I hate those kind of movies. Ugh. Every time it's, like, you know, it's mumblecore, like, you know, like, let's just sit around and, like, look at each other for 5 minutes. Nope. But in this case, I liked it because she's an alien, so you don't really know what she's thinking. It's pretty cool. And it has, like, lots of things to say about, like, you know, emotions and being human and all that kind of stuff. And I thought it was amusing that it was set in Scotland, so I could barely understand what any of the dudes that she was trying to do were saying. So, you know?
Scottish, like, production, no subtitles.
Yeah, that's what I'm going to look forward to when I get it on DVD eventually, so I can actually understand what some of these guys are saying. She's speaking with an English accent, but she'll be like, you know, oh, you blimey, mate. Would you like to come to my house? Or whatever.
That sounds just like her.
I know, but I'm kidding. And then the dude will be like, you know, we are. It's like, whoa, like, wow.
That was the best I've ever.
Pretty awesome, huh? And warning to my dad who's listening to this, you will not like it because there's a lot of nudity in it, mostly dude nudity. Naked dudes. It's, you know, it's uncomfortable nudity. Even from her, she gets naked too. But I like that it's very ambiguous and you got to figure out how it's going. But a lot of people, like reviewers, also find it, like, pretentious and lame. So, you know, the mileage may vary. Anywho, I bring this up because it's also based on a book that we have here at the magic that is the National Public Library. Supposedly, the director changed a lot. He, like, jettisoned a lot of, like, what's going on, like, actual explanation, you know. And so he changed, like, the alien's name, even though I didn't know she had a name in the movie. Did she ever say it out loud? I don't know.
I don't think she ever.
I don't think she ever does.
I saw this movie too.
So
sorry if you guys didn't gather that.
Yeah. Did you like it?
Yes, I didn't like it as much as I wanted to. Like, there actually wasn't a lot going on. I wanted more things to go on. So, you know, there's the big, you know, blurb that's going around about it is that,
it's Kubrickian.
It's Kubrickian, right?
And I read it was like Species with a little bit of Morven Callor mixed in.
Well, yeah, it does remind me of Species in a way, I guess. I don't know. I mean, I can see where, like, I read one review, and I mean, they're basically saying, I mean, I read one review that completely trashed it, and he said that instead of being, like, clever, it's just being willfully obtuse. And I could see where he could say that, where instead of explaining stuff to be clever, he's just explaining stuff just to be annoying. Not explaining stuff that is. I could totally see that. You know, it depends. Mileage may vary, as I say. But we have the book, so, you know, if you're curious as to why any of this is going on, so presumably the book will explain it by Michelle Farber.
I kind of felt like he uses in the movie, you know, the screenwriter kind of uses the alien plot just to explore, like, sexual politics.
Yes.
You know?
Yes, yes. It's like a reverse, like, rape thing.
Yeah, totally. It's like, you know, she's like this.
Is she trying to have alien babies? What's up?
Well, I could explain, but that's
yeah,
not...
Yeah, well, it's never... you know, you sort of get to...
Don't want him to wreck it, Crystal.
Yeah.
What's the fun in that? Pitch
yeah,
bash,
yeah.
Pitch bash.
And even then, it's never actually explained what she wants the men for, but you can just let your imagination run wild.
Yeah.
Yeah. So... So, okay, I think I might... This might be the wrong audience, but I thought of a new cultural, like, litmus test, okay? And it's like, are you a Tim Gunn or a RuPaul? So, Crystal.
Ooh. I know not either of those characters.
I would have to say probably Tim Gunn.
All right. Mike.
Some reality show thing I don't get. I kind of like Tim Gunn, I guess. He seems cool from
right.
interviews I've seen from him.
Okay. I'm a RuPaul, right?
Did he do the Work It CoverGirl song?
Is yeah, he did one version of that.
Yeah, probably.
Okay, well, I'm RuPaul then.
They are men who both host sort of fashion reality TV shows, but Tim Gunn his look is very conservative and elegant, and he's always very together. He has this amazing presence about him, you know, even though he just kind of looks like Roger Sterling from Mad Men. But he's just one of these people that's just like, wow, man, that guy is like, he's tight. You know what I mean? And he never wears anything fancy, but it just always looks really nice.
Very professional.
Really clean line, yeah. Where RuPaul is like the queen or king of all drag, right? And his clothes, too, are always super tight, really nice, you know, together, but completely outrageous. You know, completely outrageous, right? So, okay.
I just have issues with RuPaul that he looks better as a chick than I do. So, I mean, it probably takes him, you know, 6 hours to get ready, but still.
You know.
That's my argument.
As he's gotten older, he always wears suits now. You know,
I haven't seen him in the suit phase. I'm thinking sparkly dress. RuPaul.
He doesn't dress in drag as, you know, as much. Like half of his public experiences, you know, he's just in a suit. But, you know, where Tim's gun suit will always be gray,
mm-hmm.
like RuPaul's suit will be green.
Mm.
It'll be the same cut.
Uh-huh.
But RuPaul's will be green.
Green or orange.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, but hey, for more information, you can go to
www.library.nashville.org.
Who wrote our theme music?
Adam Dean.
Adam Dean. That's weird if you say it since you know him.
I see what she does.
You guys met through the podcast, right?
That's right.
Right.
Oh, I tickled a bit her fancy. Shredder.
And my favorite juggler is there every year. I have a huge crush on him. Okay, anyway, you can cut that part.